Welcome to Exploration 1, Module 11. This is the last chapter-based lecture. However, there are going to be another couple of lectures in the next couple of weeks that will tie up the practical aspects of the remote bundle and to assist people once the modified labs get dropped onto the server, which they will very soon, in actually doing those labs. Now, has anyone, and I don't think I posted it to announced, but has anybody been onto the remote bundle in the last few days? I would assume not. It all works, believe it or not.
I was on a while back.
Yeah, well, it actually works now. All six of the workstations come up, and the link on the workstations comes up, so you can actually ping between the workstations, and you can get at the switches, and the switches seem to work, and all that sort of thing. Now, I would warn people, and this will be going in the sort of documentation that is yet to be written, that when you power cycle the remote bundle, which you shouldn't do unless you have no other way of remedying your problem, and there are certain labs where you do need to power cycle devices, it will take at least 2 minutes for the workstations to come up because they have to be brought up after the Cisco switches have come online. Otherwise, you see no link on the workstations and they can't ping each other. So if you power cycle the bundle, it is going to take 2 minutes to come back up. Be aware of that.
So if we make changes on the bundle, does that go into effect for everyone else or just your own session?
It actually goes into effect for everyone else, and then if you really break something badly, we go in and restore the virtual machine to its previous state.
And whack your hand with a ruler.
Absolutely.
Alrighty, now before I get on to configuring and testing your network, which is looks to be the most fun chapter in the entire exploration curriculum, in my not-so-humbled opinion, has...
Up against some very stiff competition.
Oh, who knows? We'll see what happens. Has anybody got any questions, queries? Did everybody find... Now, I don't expect you to have done them. Did everybody find the folder of labs I alluded to last night? Or has anybody even got that far down in their inbox for announce?
You mean that extras thing?
Yeah, that's the one, the extras folder for the labs.
Yeah, I was about 3/4 asleep when I sent you feedback.
Ah, fair enough. Well, I haven't got to my email yet because when I came in this morning, we had no link on our stuff on this bench, and somebody had managed to turn off the switch, and I have no idea why. So once that got that turned back on, I just can't see how I would have nudged it off because it's way back. It's the furthest one back on the... So, yeah.
I found the Chapter 3.
Sabotage. Yeah, you found the Chapter 3.4.1 Modified Lab. Yeah, I know that went up along with the .jgf if you're using Windows XP for the sound recorder to label all your buttons. I'm talking about there's another folder that was put up there last night called Extras, which has some text-based labs that I want people to do their best to complete. There's two or three more subnetting exercises, a DNS lab, and a ping and traceroute sort of lab.
I actually have a question about that because I started looking. XP does not appear to have an NS lookup command.
It does. I'm just about to have a look. You can actually do it in Windows 7 or whatever, because it has it as well. NS lookup. Default server, allison.qcat.org, 192.168.100.4. It works from here. I'm not sure why yours wouldn't.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter. Maybe this installation is broken, but I mean, I can do it on Linux as well, which I probably will do because I find it easier. I thought that was a curiosity. Maybe it's just this particular installation.
NS lookup certainly exists. Anybody else with XP confirm or deny that? It exists here.
It exists. No two ways about it. XP Pro.
Yeah, I've got XP Pro here as well, but it should exist under Home as well.
if you're going into networking stuff, you should have XP Pro anyway.
I would sort of... Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have other machines. I just, when I looked at it, I was playing with the netbook, which has XP Home. And it may... It doesn't work on this particular machine, but maybe the file got deleted somehow or some weird thing.
Maybe it is Home, because I know that's what Pro...
I just tried it on Windows XP, and it does exist.
Okay, are you a Pro or a Home, Robert?
I have the Home Edition.
Oh, okay.
And I ran it from from a DOS prompt.
Yeah, okay. So it looks like you've got an oddity there. Brian, I have no idea where it went or why it's gone, but if you could snarf it off another XP box, in fact, our virtual machine image should have a copy of nslookup.exe on it, that will make it fly. Although if you want to SSH to something real, we won't hold that against you and do the lab over there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I will correct it on this box only because it's a useful tool on the netbook, but I mean, I'm probably going to do it on a Linux machine.
That's fine. Okay. I think, because that almost seems as though half your TCP utilities are missing, and I don't know why that would happen. I've never seen that happen on an XP install before. So I don't know whether there's any way of putting those back again, but yeah, odd.
Well, all the other stuff is there, ping and trace RT, and my TCP IP works properly, or I wouldn't be speaking to you, but that's, I don't know, that one's not there for some reason.
Okay. All right. So I've got ProNav's feedback that I need to read about the labs, and if people come into too many problems, I will actually modify the labs and push them back up again with the modifications made. If you, however, complete the lab before the modifications were made, I will still accept your work as a completed lab. Unless, of course, I make a modification that allows you to be able to answer a question, which then I will ask if people can answer that particular question, but I'll try to avoid that wherever possible. Okay, clear as mud? Good. Anybody got any comments and questions before we move on to Chapter 11?
I was just looking at the assignment that you put up yesterday about setting up a network setting up a network for an assistive technology company. And so I guess you want us to make the subnets, I understand, and you want us to give out the IP ranges?
I want you to give me the subnets, how many subnets you would make, what the IP ranges of those subnets would be. So, for example, the ranges for the workstations and the ranges for the router. You can lay the subnets out as you see fit. However, it would be worth noting that if you have a class C... for each of the branches, that might make your life easier. You may want to subnet a Class C, and then that way you can hand all of the VPN traffic across to the Class C, but just handle the subnetting at each individual branch. However, if you have a better way of doing it, feel free to do that. And you are required to build the routing table for three of the routers. I will edit the text file today and modify the... do you want me to shut that down? Okay, sorry guys, I just got to shut the remote bundle down. Give me 5 seconds. So basically, yeah, what will happen is you guys can... Alrighty, okay, now I'm back with it. I just had to shut down the pod so that Sean could do the recabling on it. That means that once it's all recabled, we can have a reliable remote bundle. Okay, and so check's out of there. Okay. Basically I would recommend that you guys come up with a routing table, and I'll modify the documentation. You need 3 pieces of information for for each route in the routing table. You need the network address of the route, you need the subnet mask of the route, and you need the gateway to which that route is going to be forwarded. And I will write that into the document, but does everybody vaguely remember the routing table I put in the previous exercise?
Yeah.
Okay, so I want you guys to actually... Yeah? Go ahead.
You can tell.
You're right. I insist.
Okay, so the admin stations and the workstations need to be on different subnets, but everybody needs to be able to see the file servers and the printer.
That is correct. And if it would make your life easier, you can assume that the Linux box that's acting as the router has sufficient network cards in it to have them all connected to different subnets. So it could have an admin card, a student's card, and a server farm card, or whatever would make sense for that.
Oh, I see. So three different gateways per... Okay.
Well, remember, if you don't have a gateway on the network that you're actually on, there's no way to get your packets off the network. The default gateway that you have set must be on the network that you have a route to, unless it's a point-to-point default gateway. Now, I'm not expecting everybody to come up with the answer to this straight away. In fact, I'm not even expecting everybody to understand this lab straight away. What I am expecting is for people to ask questions. And if you want to ask the questions either to CAVI instructors or me directly, whichever makes you happier, or you can ask the questions on the discuss list and people will answer you. But it is up to you where you ask the questions. If you would like other input, you can ask on the discuss list. However, it's, you know, I won't consider that cheating. I'd like you all to learn something from this lab, and if it means you all sit down and work together and only get one submission from the whole class, and you guys want to do it that way, you can do it that way. I'm not going to take off marks for stealing other people's answers, but I am going to take off marks if I ask you some questions and you've submitted me a lab and you're unable to answer them because you stole somebody else's answers. Does that all make sense?
Yeah.
I wouldn't accuse anybody of actually stealing anybody's answers. I'm just saying it can happen, not necessarily in this class group. But I want everybody to have a look through the process and look through the lab and try and understand how this works. And if not, bring your questions and we will certainly address them. Because the idea is for me to theoretically teach you something. And hopefully you guys will come out with a marketable skill that will help you in whatever you endeavor to do in the future. Did you have any other questions about that worksheet, Drew?
I don't think I will until I actually try to do the freaking thing, and then I'll probably bother you on Skype for 18 hours.
Okie dokie. You might actually want to have a look at this one, Grace. I know you don't want me to say that, but you might actually want to take a look and see how you go with it.
Fair enough.
Alrighty. Any other... do you actually need it? Because I think I still have it. I thought the lab was pretty much standalone. Have you looked at that one, Pranav? I didn't think the DNS document was actually required, but I can certainly dig it up.
I don't think it is.
No, but I don't think we need any DNS document.
I'll find it, because I actually rewrote it a couple of months back. Actually, I wrote it when I first started with the Academy. I rewrote it to make it more accessible. So I will dig that up, and if I can find it, you can all have it. Otherwise, I'll write another one. Now, has anybody here played with OpenDNS? When I say OpenDNS, I refer to www.opendns.com. Yeah, I will get that DNS document because it's worth doing. And I was asking, has anybody here played with OpenDNS.com? That www.opendns.com?
I've looked at it, but I haven't.
I'm on it right now.
Okay, yeah, so a couple of you have played with it. Look, guys, I'd strongly recommend if you haven't, and I'm not saying you have to use it, because I certainly wouldn't say that. Obviously, there are some security advantages to using it, and there's some anti-phishing stuff you can enable and stuff. However, to actually do that, I think it's like $5 a year or something. So I'm not saying you actually have to use any of the protection strategies, but if everybody could have a look... If you can have a look at www.opendns.com and have an idea as to what the site does and how you could possibly use it, it may come in handy for you in future. For example, if you're using OpenDNS and a work situation and you've pointed the work machines through OpenDNS.com, you can do things like block Facebook, YouTube, other time-wasting sites. You could probably block Twitter, which I realize would be the end of the world for some of us. You can block anti-phishing sites. You can block fraud sites, all those sorts of things. You can actually block with OpenDNS through a quite accessible control panel. Has anybody played with any of those sorts of features, or are you just using it in its it resolves my DNS stuff faster than my ISP mode?
I just wish there was... I mean, there's other ways to block time wasters as well. I mean, OpenDNS is one way to do it, but there's other ways. I just wish there was some way of routing my internet traffic through something that doesn't record my data, frankly. But what can you do about that? Nothing.
You can sign up for one of the anonymous OpenVPN sites out on the internet, or one of the anonymous VPNs, and you could route it through that. Or you could route it through the Tor network, which I think is TOR, which is a distributed set of peer-to-peer stuff. Yeah, well, I'm just giving you options. Or you could look at other anonymizing... Yeah, well, this is it. This is it.
Yeah.
Okie dokies. So, that's all very interesting, and I'd like you all to have a look at opendns.com. And if everybody doesn't have a look at... Well, actually, I might even set a lab on opendns.com just to encourage people to have a bit of a closer look at it, because it's a very good resource. I actually pay for a subscription, but that's neither here nor there. We actually have a home subscription, and I actually use it. I don't actually block anything with it, but I use it for aggregating DNS statistics as to what domains got looked up and sort of return times and that sort of stuff. So, very powerful tool. Okay, anybody else got anything else pending before we go on to the guts of 11? I think we're pretty much right to go on to the guts of 11, or at least the stuff I've got so far. Alrighty, Chapter 11, Configuring and Testing Your Network. Finally, things get exciting. After 10 chapters of theory of OSI reference models, and layer 2 is this, and layer 3 is that. Can anybody tell me what layer 3 is? You can type it into the chat if you want, just to make sure anybody remembers their layers. Layer 3, OSI reference model.
It's the network layer.
It is the network layer. Okay, anybody tell me what layer 5 is?
It's sessions.
Alrighty, yep. And Robert gets the virtual lollipop, or whatever it is he happens to want in this particular instance. And the rest of you also get one, just because, you know, it's a nice thing to do. We don't need to sing the song about My Boy Lollipop or any other song that has anything to do with that sort of thing.
It's okay. No song. Just...
Alright, fair enough. You will be the human balloon sound from XP. Okay.
That's me.
All right. So finally, you get to play with the routers. Those things that this whole course is, the stuff that Cisco wants to sell you, and the stuff that you actually get to log in and configure. Now, at the moment, the remote bundle is shut down, so if you try and telnet to it, you won't get anywhere, because it's currently being recabled by our two volunteers, bless their cotton socks, if they're wearing cotton socks. And they, once it comes back up, you will be able to connect to one of the three pods, which I also explained previously. Each pod has two routers connected by serial cables, which are mentioned in the notes, DTE to DCE. Cable is connected from router 1 to router 2, and then a DTE to DCE is connected from router 3 to router 2. So router 2 provides all of the clocks, because router 2 is meant to simulate the ISP, and you have one router on either side of the ISP, with the ISP in the middle, or the pretend ISP in the middle. Each pod has has one router, one switch, and two workstations. The two workstations are connected into the switch, and the router is also connected into the switch. Okay? Now, which brings up an interesting question. If you want to talk from pod 1 to pod 2, can anybody have any idea what you are going to have to do?
set up
route
one of
to
your
the ISP?
As a default gateway to allow packets to get out of that network?
You will have to... I got two partially correct answers. You will need to... I think Branavis was actually fairly correct. You will need to configure the routers to be able to communicate with each other. Each of the pods is isolated. So pod 1, the ISP, and pod 2 are isolated from each other. The only thing that connects them together is a serial cable from router 1 to router 2 and a serial cable from router 2 to router 3. Okay, so you are going to have to get your hands dirty in a little bit of iOS to configure up the routers, and it's not difficult. There should be enough in Chapter 11 to get you to do it, but if you can't, I'll come up with a configuration file and give it to everybody. So if you want to communicate from pod 1 to pod 3, the traffic is going to go from pod 1 to router 1. It's going to go from router 1 to the ISP router, which is router 2, and then it is going to go from router 2 to router 3. Okay? So please understand that unless you configure the routers correctly, the three pods are isolated. This will explain why if you try to ping Workstation 6 from Workstation 1, it won't work, because Workstation 6 is across on pod 3, and if you don't have any links between the two pods, it won't go. Alright, so, Chapter 11. The objectives in Chapter 11, define the role of the iOS, define the purpose of a configuration file, identify several classes of devices that have the iOS embedded. We talk about the factors that determine which commands you can have for a particular device. Identify the iOS modes of operation. Identify the basic iOS commands. And we compare and contrast the basic show commands. Now, it's probably worth mentioning that I'm going to take you guys further than this course actually takes you. I'm not very happy about it. Well, I am kind of happy about it, but I have to take you further than this course takes you so that you can actually get useful work done on the bundle. There is a subset of commands that you will need to understand before the bundle will work for you. But what I can tell you is if you continue on to Exploration 2, which we are considering running, although nothing has been set in concrete yet, you will use these bundle skills that you gained in Exploration 1. And even if you don't continue on to Exploration 2, it should be jolly good fun anyway, and in theory you guys should enjoy having a shot at it. So we are going to get quite practical. Now, I spoke to a couple of you individually. I want to draft up a lab where you guys split into three groups and you all configure part of the bundle and then get a network up and communicating so that all of your machines can talk to each other. Would anybody be interested in a lab like that? You get to fight with each other, negotiate with each other,
sure.
Help each other
out.
Sure,
be like a real office building.
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm game.
Yeah, okay, alright. Well, we'll get you all in.
I'm easy to work with. Come on, guys.
Of course you are. No, seriously. And we'll work out something that you guys can all work together and bounce around the place on the routers and see if you can get everything pingable and working and stuff. And you can all take turns at configuring bits of it. So what I would recommend is that... you know, some people take turns at configuring, say, somebody does a workstation, somebody does another workstation, and somebody does a pod, the router. So however you want to do it, and then we'll all set it up so that you guys can get, and the aim of the thing will be able to get a packet from router 1 all the way through to router 3 and back again. And we'll teach you a little bit about how to get that to work and how to, you know, ping around the network and tell it into the different workstations. Okie dokie. These notes. iOS is Cisco's networking operating system. It's the thing they charge you piles for. iOS is an operating system. Obviously, if you don't have an operating system that runs inside the switch or the router, it's not very useful. That said, very simplistic switches such as the $20 version that you got from Walgreens, and yes, I know Walgreens is a supermarket, but you get it from Walmart, perhaps. Is not going to have a very complex
Walmart's
operating system.
Walgreens is a pharmacy.
Yeah, Walgreens is a pharmacy, so you might be able to... Can't you get some electronics from Walmart, sort of, sometimes? Like, really dicey stuff?
I'm sure you could get routers from Walmart.
Well, just a
you
little
can get
switch,
anything like from a... Walmart. You can get the soul of a small child from Walmart.
Wow.
At a discount for $10.99.
Yeah, you probably could. Whether it would be any good and whether it would be something you'd want to buy would remain to be seen. You've got to be careful as far as I've been told. So, anyway, you don't have very complicated operating systems in the cheap switches that you get off the shelf. Basically, they store and forward. They have a content CAM memory, which is the content address memory, that figures out which packets go onto which ports. And that's about all they do. There's no user serviceable parts inside. If you take a screwdriver to the switch and open it up, you end up with a situation where you've just got a circuit board and a couple of incomprehensible integrated circuits, and there's nothing you can do once you've got it open, so you put it back together again. I pulled a couple of dead switches apart just to see what was in them. I had one go bang once, so I opened it up, and it was just a circuit board and some RJ45 ports and not much exciting. Okay. The iOS provides basic routing and switching functions, reliable and secure access to network resources, network scalability. Now, if you saw this stuff in the notes, well done, because that's where I cut and pasted it from. iOS runs from... See, I'm allowed to plagiarize because I'm an instructor. Anyway, it's not called plagiarism, it's research. iOS runs from... It generally comes from Flash. So the iOS image is usually stored in Flash. It can be pulled over a network via TFTP, but such setups are not necessarily recommended because you are then reliant on the TFTP server to be up to be able to boot your router, which is not a good idea. TFTP being Trivial File Transfer Protocol, a UDP-based sending and receiving protocol that is used to bootstrap diskless workstations, routers, and other devices that will obtain their operating system from a network. Has anybody ever played with TFTP? I've used it for upgrading the firmware on Linksys routers.
It's sometimes necessary when the web interface has destroyed itself. Like if you screw up an update.
Sorry, you've used it for what? Sorry, Brian?
Configuring VoIP phones where I didn't feel like going into the web interface, just mostly because I only had three, mostly just to see if I could do it, but where I could push an image onto a phone.
Yeah, has anybody noticed, and I don't know whether you've seen the Sapura 3102, but it apparently can pull its configuration via TFTP, but they don't tell you how to do it. They sort of give you about as much information as you possibly can so that you think you can actually do it, and then they go, no, you've got to buy a really expensive document if you want to do the configurations via TFTP. I was not happy about that, but there you have it. Yeah, there are VoIP phones that can take their configuration via TFTP, and it's sometimes useful so that if you've got, say, an office of, you know, 30 VoIP phones, you can set up a configuration file or a set of, or 30 configuration files even, on the server, and you can turn the VoIP phones on and they will retrieve their configuration files. Can anybody give me some idea, apart from Brian, who will know the answer, as to what you might key on to hand out the correct configuration file to the correct VoIP phone?
How about the MAC address for the VoIP phone?
That sounds pretty good to me.
And I assume there must be some way of setting... You have to set up each VoIP phone to actually do this automatically, right?
Some of them will do it automatically when you turn them on. They'll actually try by default to pick up a TFTP image. The other, yeah, that's correct, Josh, MAC addresses. You can also, sometimes you dial in a series of tones from the keypad. So for example, with my Sapuras, you plug a phone into port 1, and you dial star, 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 and it says configuration, Linksys configuration menu. And then you can dial in things like 110 to get the IP address and all that sort of stuff. I'm sure Brian's had far too much to do with that in his years of messing with VoIP phones. It can be handy, though, to get configuration information out of the VoIP phone without reading the screen. Okie dokies. There we go. Now, generally the iOS is loaded into memory. So you've got to have enough RAM in your router to hold the iOS image. And the iOS image in some devices can be compressed, and it can be decompressed into RAM. And it's kind of fun, and this is really, really sad and blind, to actually, if you have a Braille display, to reboot the Cisco router and watch the startup messages, and it puts little number signs that scroll along the Braille display as the image is uncompressed into memory. So if you have a Braille display and you want to do this, I'll show you guys how to power off and power on the switch, because I'd like you all to see how a router boots up. Now, with the remote bundle, you have what we call a remote power manager, which has 16 on-off switches, and you can actually control those from a Telnet session. It's on port 2 of the remote bundle. It's called power, and it will allow you to turn on and off things. So what you do is you slash on the plug that contains the router. You then alt-tab into the other Telnet session that you have open, and you can actually watch the router come up, which I think is kind of cool. I believe there is a limit to 6 incoming Telnet sessions into the remote bundle, so keep that in mind when you guys are working together. It's okay to have 1 or 2 Telnet sessions open, but what... am I still on, guys?
Okay, I take it your routers aren't on a UPS.
They're not at the moment. We had a UPS that died, and I've got to get around to ordering the replacement battery for it, and I've got to discuss that with our fearless leader, which was a UPS I had donated. And then I bought in another UPS, which is currently running the file server, but the file server isn't in the same room that the router is in, so, and because I donated the second UPS temporarily, that's all the UPSs we have. See budget. So if anybody wants to donate to QCAT and you're listening to this recording and you've got too much money, donate to Cavi. We could do with it. But we will do something to get them on a UPS at some point.
I would think in a commercial environment you would want to do something like have your would want to have your VoIP phones on a UPS, so if your power went out, your whole company didn't suddenly shut down without phones.
I agree with you. The shipping wouldn't be less than the value of the equipment. That would be the problem. No, we are going to sort something out. You can have everything on the UPS, and it would help to have your VoIP phones on the UPS, but obviously the weak link in the chain is the actual internet. So if the internet goes down, all your VoIP is down. And that can be quite a problem for a business. And we've had it happen here a couple of times where the main internet for this... There are actually two internet links into this building. There's one we use, and there's one that the rest of the association uses. And we are actually on our own internet link because they don't trust us to be on theirs. And I don't blame them. We are a pretty rowdy bunch. That's essentially how that works. We are actually going to come up with some more. The UPS is just a theory. We originally switched out the Netcom router for a Cisco, which we eventually got set up and configured, and we actually haven't had these problems until, like, extremely badly until today. So this is where we go and troubleshoot the whole thing again and find out what else we can do until we find out that it's actually a sync problem and we can't do anything about it, which is also possible. Okie dokie. Now, you can access the iOS in 3 main ways. You can access it via the Telnet port. You can access it by the AUX port, or the OR port, as Jaws says. So I think that's something to do with Jaws' attempt to semi-speak French, or Eloquence's attempt to semi-speak French. So I would be tempted to go into your Jaws dictionary and put in an exception for AUX, because it's certainly not pronounced OR. It always makes me laugh that some of these synthesizers attempt to be multilingual in the language that they're talking in, and some quite bizarre oddities. Now, the console port is what you guys will be accessing your router over when you use the remote bundle. There are 6 console ports, one for each switch, one for each router, and then there's another 6 serial ports coming off the virtual workstations. So all up, there's 12 serial ports and 12 null modem cables all plugging into a 16-port serial switch. Hence my tweet the other day for anybody who follows me on Twitter. Quite a number of serial cables to deal with. You will be accessing it over the serial port using your Telnet or terminal emulator of choice. If you're running Windows anywhere from 95 to Windows 7, I would strongly suggest that you set up TerraTerm, JAWS, and the script. However, if you want to be adventurous and set up Cygwin, feel free, although you will have to find some way of getting Cygwin's Telnet to take over Windows Telnet. And I am told that the Cygwin Telnet works quite well with NVDA. Now, I assume everybody knows that 2010.2 of NVDA is out. If, in case you haven't been living under a rock or something, 2010.2 of NVDA, the real release, is out. And if you haven't played with NVDA, may I strongly recommend that you go and grab a copy for the pure reason that when JAWS falls over, you can press Control-Alt-N.
Yeah, if you are using NVDA, then you really should get it.
Yeah, if you're currently using NVDA, you should upgrade. And if you're not using NVDA and you enjoy using the Rater, well, there's nothing I can do for you. But if you aren't using NVDA and you want something that is something that may come up when JAWS has fallen over, which, of course, we all know never happens, you may want to install NVDA and then you can press Control-Alt-N and it will come up and work. We may do a Friday morning chat on NVDA, if anybody's interested. Might be a good excuse for me to mess around with this virtual audio cable stuff again. And we will demonstrate how NVDA works, and I will find some applications where the object navigation works, and I will demonstrate the object navigation and the flat review mode and all of that fun stuff that people keep asking about but nobody seems to want to mess with because they haven't quite got to it yet. Okay, the other way you can get to the router CLI. Now, unfortunately for Grace, the best way to configure these routers is with a command line interface. Oh, why? Because it's low bandwidth, because it is reliable, and because it is very good for doing remotely. Has anybody ever tried reading their Hotmail or whatever over a 1G or 2G mobile phone connection, like a dial-up modem link?
Thank goodness for mobile sites now.
Who's got a mobile site?
I believe Hotmail does.
Has anybody used it?
I use Mobile Yahoo all the time.
People still use
Hotmail.
Yeah, I've never had much luck with Hotmail. The one I use is Fastmail, which I pay money for. But it's really good and it's fairly fast and they give you IMAP access. In fact, you can get a free IMAP inbox, but you have to send your mail out through an IMAP, through an SMTP server somewhere else. If, however, you use, you pay the money, you can get an SMTP server. So that's fastmail.fm and it rocks. It's one of my highly recommendeds. You can relay all of your outgoing email through Gmail, but unless I'm missing something, Gmail goes and rewrites all the headers on you so that it looks as though it came from your Gmail. Has anybody tried this and actually got it to work without rewriting all the headers, or has nobody tried this and I'm just the only madman here at the moment?
I have something similar. I've got a domain that's not Google, but that uses like the Google Apps, Google Mail, for the DNS, like as a redirect. So it uses like Google Mail DNS server, so it sort of shows up as coming from the domain name, and then like it shows Google Mail as like a parentheses thing. So like when it's like received from or something like that.
Okay, well, we'll look into that. I saw an article on how to relay all of your mail out through Gmail, but when I tried it, it ended up rewriting all the headers, and then it showed up as coming from my Gmail, which wasn't what I wanted it to do. And we were looking at that because, as everybody would know, Comcast hates us. It hates Amcom, and it hates IINet, and it hates all of the people that we send mail out through. And in fact, its anti-spam policy is so draconian that getting messages into Comcast is much, much harder than asking the Comcast users to please get themselves a Gmail so that we can email them, which is now our official policy. I used to relay through MailHop, which was receivable by Comcast. However, I only get 150 forwards per day, and a message to the mailing list would generate 160. So that's why we didn't do that. Okay. You can access the router CLI by using SSH or Telnet. SSH is Secure Shell. It is an encrypted transport. It can optionally also support compression. I have no idea whether the Cisco SSH implementation supports compression. However, if you are doing remote administration over low-speed links, I would highly recommend that you enable compression on your SSH, which is the -c command line option, or you put compression yes into your .ssh/config file for the host stanza that you want compression enabled for. And that may make no sense to a lot of you, but believe me, it will once you start messing with the Linux boxes. Now, we do apologize for the fact that you do end up getting chucked in the deep end with Linux, but if anybody can find a cheap way of remotely handing Windows audio out of the remote bundle in an effective way, you can have Windows boxes to mess with, but until we get that sorted, you have Linux boxes. Okay, now the AUX port can be used. Sometimes you can connect a backup dial-up modem in, and you can set the modem to answer so that you can dial in on the modem and access the configuration of the modem of the router from the modem, which is a good backup strategy. However, you do have to look at security and stuff for that, because you don't want anybody dialing into that modem and doing... is what linked down again? Have you lost my audio, Alex, or not?
You can start.
You guys all... okay. I think Josh is having internet problems for once.
You're good here in Louisiana.
Surely good. And it's just about a mile from a Texarkana, apparently, from those old cotton fields back home. I don't think they've got cotton. Do they still have cotton fields there?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, okay. Yeah, just too much Charlie Pride in my misspent youth. At least I think he was the one who was singing it. Okay. Now, the AUX port does not show startup messages and debug messages by default, so that's why you guys are wired into the console ports when you go onto the remote bundle. And is everybody following... who's got Twitter? Are they all following Cisco Vision?
No. Wait, yes, I am.
Okay, we're trying to make that more useful, and there haven't been that many tweets on there, but as you'll see, there have been more tweets than previous. So we're trying to make that into a useful resource. So the Cisco devices are configured with a config file. The config files are a text file. The config files are a text file. The config files are a text file. This is really important. This means you can open them in Notepad, WordPad, Notepad++, Emacs, VI, Ed, whatever you happen to want to be using, and you can edit them before you shovel them back into the router. And in fact, on extreme low bandwidth situations, it can be advantageous to rip the configuration file down onto your workstation, mess with it, and then shove it back up onto the router. And we will be showing you all how to do that. You can also back up the configuration files using TFTP onto your workstations. And I don't think we cover that in this particular course, but you can all back up your configuration files onto the virtual workstations, and that might be kind of cool, because it's a sensible thing to do. Now, the startup config is stored in non-volatile memory, and the running config is the router configuration that the router is currently using. if you wish to save the current config of the router so that it will be used next time, you must copy running config to startup config. What happens if you do not copy running config to startup config and you have made changes? Can anybody tell me?
You lose your changes.
It would lose the changes because it's in non. You have to transfer it from non-volatile to volatile memory.
You need to whoever you are, I'm not talking to you on the phone. You need to transfer it to from volatile memory to non-volatile memory. In fact, I'll just take that offline for the moment because I don't need to.
That'll have it. Hold.
Give me that cell phone. Why are you answering your cell phone in class?
Well, this is exactly my point. I wouldn't generally answer my phone in class, but it was ringing, and I just took it offline because it's probably a good idea. But whoever it was decided they'd ring home, so Grace can deal with it. Ain't that grand? Okay. The iOS is a modal operating system. This is vitally important, okay? Underline, italics, scream by six people who we've paid to scream it out. It's modal. You need to know what mode you are in, okay? Now, this is a gotcha. If you are using JAWS and you're one of these people that turns their punctuation down below most, you are in trouble unless you have a braille display. Okay, so please, when you are using TerraTerm or CRT or whatever you are using, please put your punctuation up to at least most so that you can hear punctuation symbols such as number sign, greater than, dollar, and those sorts of things. Just out of morbid curiosity, how many people here do run their punctuation below most? I know Grace does.
Mine is set to none.
But I'm not sure what it is.
You can override the punctuation for a specific application. I would strongly recommend that you open TerraTerm Insert 6 and tell it to use most punctuation because the punctuation is important when you are working on Cisco routers. Unless you have a braille display, and then you can see it.
I don't understand why they have two punctuation settings and then an option to choose which one it listens to, because shouldn't they just have one?
Does anybody want to demystify that? I thought there was a reading punctuation and a review punctuation. I know there isn't speak up, which is kind of cool.
No, there's a punctuation comma box in the synthesizer options dialog in the configuration manager, and there's also a punctuation options in the voice settings dialog, and then somewhere, I think in the synthesizer box, there's a radio button that says whether the punctuation mode should be controlled by JAWS or the synthesizer, and I just think it makes sense to have it not give you the choice and just...
There is a reason for it, because some people want this punctuation to be handled by the synthesizer, and they like the way that the synthesizer does the punctuation, and sometimes they want JAWS to handle the punctuation. Now, if you're me, and obviously I'm me and nobody else is, you usually get bored one day and rip through the default dictionary in JAWS, and you change full stop or period to be dot. You replace question mark with question, you put exclamation mark as bang, you put number sign as number, and you change all of these so that they are single syllable words so that when you are reviewing things are faster. And you may want to do this for the dictionary and TerraTerm if you don't like the pronunciation of the punctuation. You might want to change it to hash if you're an efficiency freak, rather than number.
Okay, so it's because the synthesizer has a different... okay, that makes some sense.
The other thing is, some of us, I still am a diehard, and I like my hardware speech. I have triple talks, a couple of them, because I like the speech, and they actually handle punctuation differently than Eloquence, and I actually change it when I'm using a hardware synthesizer because I want it to deal with the punctuation, because I like... how it says things.
Yeah, does it drive anybody else bonkers with JAWS how if there are more than three of a particular symbol, it just says number, 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 and doesn't tell you how many of them they are? Smack, Freedom Scientific. Yeah, but how do you... It doesn't actually count the number of number signs. So it doesn't say 40 number signs. It'll just say number sign 40 times.
I believe
you
can have it do that. I'm pretty sure that one of the options can be... I'm going to check now, because I remember seeing it there once, and I don't remember seeing it recently. Oh, well, have a look.
It's actually a problem, because if you're doing binary and you've got eight ones, it just says 111, which is not the eight that you put down. But then you... Yeah, anyway... So, yeah, some of us prefer the way the hardware synthesizers deal with punctuation. And some of us prefer different things to handle it. So that's the reason behind it.
Yeah, you can do that. You go into text processing and change it to count repeated characters.
Okay, it never used to be in there, or it was hidden away. I remember that
maybe
there was...
Maybe it's a default-only thing.
We'll have a play with that. Okay, so your basic modes, user exec mode... Privileged exec mode, global configuration, and other specific configuration modes. Now, the user access mode has a prompt of router greater. That is shift and full stop, or the crocodile facing to the left. So that's the greater than symbol. If you have your punctuation set below most, you won't hear the greater than symbol, okay? So I'm not going to give the punctuation rant again. However, if you don't know what mode your router is in and you've got your punctuation level set too low to find out, then I'm sorry, that's your problem. So seriously, it's important. PrivExec mode is router number, which is the mode where you can change all of the settings in the router and do various configuration-y bits. And anybody may have noticed that the prompt for the privileged exec mode is the number, the hash, the octothorpe, the noughts and crosses grid. It is meant to symbolize the root prompt or the superuser prompt of a Unix-based operating system, hence the hash mark. Global config mode, router, left paren, config, right paren, number. That is where you're actually putting in basic things where you're setting the clock, and you can drop into other modes from global configuration, such as interface configuration mode, router configuration mode, RIP configuration mode, all of those sorts of things. The user exec mode is view only. It's got limited set of commands. You can basically drop in there and do some show commands, but you can't execute any commands that would change the router's configuration from user exec mode. The prompt being router greater than, or the host name of the router, followed by a greater than symbol. Use the enable command to access the privileged access mode. Disable will get you out of it again. Has anybody done any of this before?
I did last spring. It's been a while. And what was that prompt for the global mode?
It was router, left paren, config, right paren, number.
Can you have different password levels, like where someone can go in as, user exec mode, and then if they want to change to privilege exec mode, they have to... Kind of like the SU command?
Oh, my wordy yes. Absolutely. In fact, Cisco is quite granular in that response. And I will be covering the passwords further down in the notes. And I'll talk about those in a second. Now, commands have command names and arguments. Now, an argument is not a domestic. An argument is a subsequent word that goes on to a command that tells the command what to do. So, for example, if you have the command show space running dash config, the show is the command name, which is the first word, and the second word is the first argument to that command, which is running dash config. If anybody has done DOS, DIR space slash W, DIR is the command, and slash W is the switch or the optional argument to the DIR command that will show you it in wide format. Now, some people will be interested to know that the Cisco routers do have a web interface. However, the web interface is fairly insecure. It is not recommended, and it is only designed for initial, basic, simple router configuration. And if you're doing real Cisco courses like this one, you don't get to use the web interface very much. Command names are not case sensitive, so you can type the command names in uppercase or lowercase, the router doesn't care. And funnily enough, you hit enter to execute commands. Anyone got any questions so far other than the password stuff that I'm going to cover in a minute?
So how do you switch modes? So it's like the command line. How do you switch from one mode to another? You just type the, like that, for example, to get to the privilege mode, you just type the, what was it, left paren, router, right paren.
No. I covered this. Anybody answer Josh's question?
You type the word enable to get into privilege mode, and you type the word disable to get into to get back to the sort of the user mode, and probably to get into global configuration, I think you have to type config if memory serves me right.
You type config space terminal or config space T to get into global configuration mode.
It's been a few months.
Yeah, that's okay. You're doing well. And I'm sure it'll all come back to you once you actually get in and start messing with the routers. Enable gets you into privileged exec mode, and disable gets you out again. I did mention that a little bit earlier. Okay. Now, there are rules for how this syntax stuff is written out, and I'm going to go over these because they're important and because you may have seen this stuff before, but it may not have sunk in. If you have an argument in brackets, they are optional arguments. So that's left bracket, right bracket. They're the ones next to the P. They're the things that JAWS calls brackets. If you have things in braces, that is a required argument. If you have left brace A bar, B bar, C, you must pick A or B or C. Okay, so the bar means or. Any questions on that? Because that is sort of notation that a lot of things use and not a lot of things go through. Okay, now the other thing you can do, which will help everybody out, in fact, a lot of people do Cisco configuration purely by using this setup, question mark will show you context-sensitive help. If you press question mark at the beginning of the command line, it will show you every command that you can use in that particular mode. If you type a couple of letters and then you press the question mark, such as SH question mark, you can then see what commands start with SH. If you would like to know what arguments can be passed to the show command, you can put show space question mark. Ain't that cool? I would encourage people, when the remote bundle gets turned back on again, to log in and have a play with those question marks and the context-sensitive help that's mentioned in Chapter 11, and you will be able to see how that context-sensitive help works. There are three problems you can have with a command. You can have an ambiguous command, so if you put SH and it doesn't know whether you want show or something else. Incomplete command means you haven't put enough arguments in for the command and it needs to know more. Invalid command is something that you've typed in and you mispressed the wrong buttons and typed in the wrong word. Now the problem with the Cisco thing is that it does tend to say error at caret marker, and then it indents the caret marker to line up with the problem on the particular command line, so you may either have to use Braille or be very clever and go up by a column and figure out where the actual error in the command line is with JAWS. So yeah, look forward to that. We have a set of keyboard shortcuts that the chapter goes through here, which I'll cover briefly. Tab completes the command, so if you type SE and hit tab, it will probably complete out to set if that is a valid completion. Anybody who has used Linux before will know about tab completion. How many people knew that it worked in Windows?
Yeah, I did, but I never used it. It used to work in DOS 5 and 6 as well, but you had to load DOS key.
Yeah, it also works. There are actually registry hacks where you can put it into the run dialog and it'll actually work there, which is kind of handy. I use command completion a lot because one of the things command completion will do for you under Windows is that it will put quotes around the files that need quotes around them, and you basically just keep hitting tab until it says the right file name and then hit space, and it'll have the quotes around files with spaces in them and stuff, so it can be quite a time saver. Okay, Control R redraws the current line. So if you've got a console message that's messed up your display and you want to see the line that you were typing because the console message sort of messed it up, Control R will get that back for you. Control Z exits config mode, which is also the ASCII end of file marker. Up and down arrows will scroll through the history. Control Shift 6 or Control At will abort things like ping and traceroute. They will abort a command that you've started off on a router, and it's good if you know, for example, that a traceroute is going to fail. You can hit Control-Shift-6, and it will bail out of the traceroute. And Control-C will abort the current command, in theory. Backspace will del the character. Control-D deletes the character at the server. Control-K erases all characters from where the cursor is at the moment until the end of the line. Erases all characters from where you are to the end of the word. Control U or Control X erases all characters from where you are back to the beginning of the line. Control W erases the previous word. Control A moves it to the beginning of the line. And Control B moves the character 1 to the left. And Escape B moves the cursor back by a word. So there's lots of commands here that are summarized in the chapter. Can anybody tell me, and you get like a virtual lollipop if you know the answer to this one, what those key bindings look similar to, especially Escape B, Escape F, Control B, Control F, Control A, Control E? Can anybody tell me where they come from?
The VI editor in Linux?
No.
The Windows commands?
No.
WordStar, actually.
Yeah, they do originally come from WordStar. I was thinking more of Emacs.
Yeah, which I've played with a little bit, but never gotten my head around. Sorry, I can't do it.
Yeah, it's a parity shift. Basically, Emacs Speak is pretty cool if you can figure out how to use it. Although I haven't found the mailing list a very friendly environment, and usually you post a question and you get a reply back going, oh, well, that's perfectly obvious. If you wanted to do that, edit line 207 of emacs-functions.l, and it'll do that. And you go, oh, how stupid of me. I should have known. At the more prompt, enter displays the next line, space displays the next screen, and any alphanumeric key returns to the exec prompt. So it works like more under Linux, Windows, all that sort of thing. I tell you what, I'm going to stop there. I know it's a bit early, but I'm going to stop there until I've actually got my audio passing through so that I can actually show you guys how these commands operate. Does anybody have any questions before we finish up the lecture?
I thought serial connections were out of band, like the console connections. They still have IPs, is it?
No, the console is out of band. No. The console connection is out of band, and you cannot assign an IP address to a console port. So, yes, they are completely out of band, which allows you to set all of the other IP addresses on all the other interfaces from the remote power switch.
Yeah, so how are we connecting to it then in the bundle if it doesn't have an IP?
Okay, that's a good question. Basically, the serial switch, which has 16 ports on it, has an IP address. And it just so happens that the telnet port of www.qcat.org is redirected through to that serial switch. Once you connect to the serial switch and you are at the CMS prompt, you go /C and a number, and it connects to any of the ports between 1 and 16. Once you are connected to the serial port, you are then talking to either a router's console, a switch's console, or a serial console of a virtual Linux box.
Okay, so it's the switch that... switch has an IP address. Interesting. Okay.
Well, it's a serial switch. It's got one Ethernet port that you assign an IP address, a subnet mask, and a default gateway to, and then it has 16 serial ports that you get to connect to. It's all very clever, really, when you think about it. We're pretty impressed with it anyway. Okay, any other questions? Sorry about the slight disorganization today. It does happen from time to time, and we'll try and make next week's lecture much more on track, and we hope you all got something out of this, even with the stops and starts and the interruptions. So my apologies for that, and we'll try and do better next week.